You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show.
In the last show, we were looking at the book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles by Bruce H. Lipton, PhD. We were talking about some of the strange experiences that transplant recipients experience, of a strange dreams and experiences after they get someone else's organ. One theory about how these behaviors become implanted into the transplant recipient along with the organ is something known as cellular memory, i.e., the notion that somehow memories are embedded in cells. You know, I have an immense respect for the intelligence of single cells, but many scientists draw the line here. Yes, cells can remember that they are muscle cells or liver cells, but there is a limit to their intelligence. I do not believe cells are physically endowed with perception mechanisms that can distinguish and remember a taste for something like, for example, chicken nuggets. Psychological and behavioral memory does make sense if we realize that the transplanted organs still bear the original identity receptors of the donor and are apparently still downloading that same environmental information. Even though the body of the person who donated the organs is dead, their broadcast apparently is still on. They are, as I realized in my flash of insight while mulling over the mechanics of the cellular membrane, immortal, as I believe we all are. Cells and organ transplants offer a model not only for immortality, but also for reincarnation. Consider the possibility that an embryo in the future displays the same set of identity receptors that I now possess. That embryo will be turned into my quote-unquote self. My identity is back, but playing through a different body. Sexism and racism become ridiculous as well as immoral when you realize that your receptors could wind up on a white person, a black person, an Asian, or male or female. Because the environment represents all that is, which some people call God, and our self-receptor antennas download only a narrow band of the whole spectrum, we all represent a small part of the whole, a small part of the universe, or, if you prefer, a small part of God. Earthlanders. While a TV analogy might be useful, it is not a complete one because a television is only a playback device. In the course of our lives, what we do alters the environment. We change the environment simply by being here. So a more complete way of understanding our relationship to spirit is to compare a human to the Martian rovers Spirit and Opportunity, or other NASA landers we have sent to the Moon and Mars. Humans are not able to go physically to Mars, but we really want to know what it would be like to land on Mars. So we send up the equivalent of a human explorer. Although the Mars rovers don't physically resemble a human, They have functions of humans. These vehicles have cameras, which are the eyes and see the planet. They have vibration detectors, which are the ears that hear the planet. They have chemical receptors, which taste the planet. So the lander is designed with sensors that can experience Mars somewhat as a human would experience it. But let's look a little more closely on how the Mars rovers work. The rovers have antennas, receptors, that are tuned to receive information broadcast by a human being in the form of a NASA controller. The Earth-bound controller actually sends information that animates the mariner on Mars. But the information is not a one-way street. The NASA controller also learns from the lander, because the vehicle transmits information about its Mars experiences back to Earth. The NASA controller interprets the information about the lander's experiences and then applies that new awareness to better navigate the Martian terrain. You and I are like Earth landers, quote-unquote, who receive information from an environmental controller slash spirit. As we live our lives, the experiences of our world are sent back to that controller, our spirit. So the character of how you live your life influences the character of yourself. This interaction corresponds to the concept of karma. When we understand it, we must take heed of a life we live on this planet, because the consequences of our life last longer than our bodies. What we do during our lifetime can bring back to haunt us or a future version of ourselves. In the end, these cellular insights serve to emphasize the wisdom of spiritual teachers throughout the ages. Each of us is a spirit in material form. A powerful image for the spiritual truth is the way light interacts with a prism. When a beam of white light goes through a prism, the prism's crystalline structure refracts the existing light so that it appears as a rainbow spectrum. Each color, though a component of the white light, is seen separately because of its unique frequency. If you reverse the process by projecting a rainbow spectrum through the crystal, the individual frequencies will recombine, forming a beam of white light. Think of each human being's identity as an individual color frequency within a narrow spectrum. If we arbitrarily eliminate a specific frequency, a color, because we don't like it, quote unquote, and we then try to put the remaining frequencies back through the prism, the existing beam will no longer be white light. By definition, white light is composed of all the frequencies. Many spiritual people anticipate the return of white light to the planet. They imagine that it will come in the form of a unique individual, such as Buddha, Jesus, or Muhammad. However, from my newly acquired spirituality, I see the white light will only return to the planet when every human being recognizes every other human being as an individual frequency of white light. As long as we keep eliminating or devaluating other human beings we've decided we don't like, i.e., destroying frequencies of the spectrum, we will not be able to experience the white light. Our job is to protect and nurture each human frequency so that the white light can return. Fractal evolution, a theory we can live with. I've explained why I am now a spiritual scientist. Now I'd like to explain why I am an optimist. The story of evolution is a story of repeating patterns. We are at a crisis point, but the planet has been here before. Evolution has been punctuated with upheavals, which virtually wiped out existing species, including the best-known casualties, the dinosaurs. Those upheavals were directly linked to environmental catastrophes, as today's crisis is. As the human population increases, We are competing for space with the other organisms with whom we share the planet. But the good news is that similar pressures in the past have brought into being new ways of living, and we'll do so again. We are concluding one evolutionary cycle and preparing to embark upon another. As this cycle comes to an end, people are becoming understandably apprehensive and alarmed by the failures in the structures that support civilization. I believe, however, that the dinosaurs that are currently raping nature will become extinct. The survivors will be those who realize that through our thoughtless ways are destructive to the planet and to us. How can I be so sure? My certitude comes from my study of fractal geometry. Here is a definition of geometry, which will explain why it is important for studying the structure of our biosphere. Geometry is a mathematical assessment of the way the different parts of something fit together in relationship to each other. That is so important that I will repeat it. Geometry is a mathematical assessment of the way the different parts of something fit together in relationship to each other. Until 1975, the only geometry available for study was Euclidean, which was summarized in the 13-volume ancient Greek text, The Element of Euclid, written around 300 BC. For spatially oriented students, Euclidean geometry is easy to understand because it deals with structures like cubes and spheres and cones that can be mapped on graph paper. However, Euclidean geometry does not apply to nature. For example, you cannot map a tree, a cloud, or a mountain using mathematical formulas of this geometry. In nature, most organic and inorganic structures display more irregular or chaotic appearing patterns. These natural images can only be created by using the recently discovered mathematics of fractal geometry. French mathematician Bernard Mandelbrot launched the field of fractal mathematics and geometry in 1975. Like quantum physics, fractal or fractional geometry forces us to consider those irregular patterns, a quirkier world of curvy shapes and objects with more than three dimensions. The mathematics of fractals is amazingly simple, because you need only one equation, using only simple multiplication and addition. The same equation is then repeated ad infinitum. For example, the Mandelbrot set is based on the simple formula of taking a number, multiplying it by itself, and then adding the original number. The result of that equation is then used as the input for the subsequent equation. The result of that equation is then used as an input for the next equation, and so on. The challenge is that even though each equation follows the same formula, these equations must be repeated millions of times to actually visualize a fractal pattern. The manual labor and time needed to complete millions of equations prevented early mathematicians from recognizing the values of fractal geometry. With the advent of powerful computers, however, Mandelbrot was able to define this new math. Inherent in the geometry of fractals is the creation of ever-repeating self-similar patterns nested within one another. You can get a rough idea of repeating shapes by picturing the internally popular toy, hand-painted Russian nested dolls. Each smaller structure is a miniature but not necessarily an exact version of the larger form. Fractal geometry emphasizes the relationship between the pattern in a whole structure and the pattern seen in parts of the structure. For example, the pattern of twigs on a beach resembles the pattern of limbs branching off a tree trunk. The patterns of major rivers look like the patterns of the smaller tributaries. In the human lung, the fractal pattern of branching along the bronchii repeats in smaller and smaller bronchioles. The arterial and venous blood vessels and the peripheral nervous system also display similar repeating patterns? Are the repetitive images observed in nature simply a coincidence? I believe the answer is definitely no. To explain why I believe fractal geometry defines the structure of life, let's revisit two points. First, the story of evolution is, as I emphasize many times in the book, the story of ascension to higher awareness. Second, in our study of the membrane, we define the receptor effector protein complex, IMPs, as the fundamental unit of awareness and intelligence. Consequently, the more receptor effector proteins, the olives in our bread and the butter in the butter sandwich model, an organism possesses, the more awareness it can have and the higher it is on the evolutionary ladder. However, there are physical restrictions for increasing the number of receptor effector proteins that can be packed into the cell's membrane. The cell's membrane thickness measures 7 to 8 nanometers, the diameter of the phospholipid bilayer. The average diameter of the receptor effector awareness proteins is approximately the same as the phospholipids in which they are embedded. Because the membrane's thickness is so tightly defined, you can't cram in a lots of IMPs by stacking them on top of one another. You're stuck with a one protein thick layer. Consequently, the only option for increasing the number of awareness proteins is to increase the surface area of the membrane.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles by Bruce H. Lipton, Ph.D. We're now in the section, the epilogue, and we're going to wrap up all of the information that we presented in this very interesting book. Let's go back to our membrane sandwich model. More olives mean more awareness. The more olives you can layer in the sandwich, the smarter the sandwich, which is more intelligence capacity, a slice of cocktail rye or a large slab of sourdough. The answer is simple. The larger the surface area of the bread, the greater the number of olives that can fit into the sandwich. Relating this analogy to biological awareness, the more membrane surface area the cell has, the more protein olives it can manage. Evolution, the expansion of awareness, could then be physically defined by the increase in membrane surface area. Mathematical studies have found that fractal geometry is the best way to get the most surface area, membrane, within a three-dimensional space, the cell. Therefore, evolution has now become a fractal affair. Repeating patterns in nature are a necessity, not a coincidence of fractal evolution. My point here is not to get caught up in the mathematical details of modeling. There are repetitive fractal patterns in nature and evolution as well. The strikingly beautiful computer-generated pictures that illustrate fractal patterns that remind us that, despite our modern angst and the seeming chaos of our world, there is order in nature, and there's nothing truly new under the sun. Evolution's repetitive fractal patterns allow us to predict that humans can figure out how to expand their consciousness in order to climb another rung of the evolutionary ladder. The exciting, esoteric world of fractal geometry provides a mathematical model that suggests that the arbitrariness, planlessness, randomness, and accident that Mayer wrote about is an outdated concept. In fact, I believe that an idea that does not serve humanity and should, as rapidly as possible, go the way of the pre-Copernican Earth-centered universe. Once we realize that there are repeating ordered patterns in nature and evolution, the lives of cells, which inspired this book and the changes in my life, become even more instructive. For billions of years, cellular living systems have been carrying out an effective peace plan that enables them to enhance their survival, as well as the survival of other organisms in the biosphere. Imagine a population of trillions of individuals living under one roof in a state of perpetual happiness. Such a community exists. It is called the healthy human body. Clearly, cellular communities work better than human communities. There are no left-out homeless cells in our bodies. Unless, of course, our cellular communities are in profound disharmony, causing some cells to withdraw from cooperating with the community. Cancers essentially represent homeless, jobless cells that are living off the cells in the community. If humans were to model the lifestyle displayed by healthy communities of cells, our societies and our planet would be more peaceful and vital. Creating such a peaceful community is a challenge because every person perceives the world differently. So essentially, there are 6 billion human versions of reality on this planet, each perceiving its own truth. As the population grows, they are bumping up against each other. Cells faced a similar challenge in early evolution as described in Chapter 1, but the point bears repeating. Shortly after Earth was formed, single-celled organisms rapidly evolved. Thousands of variations of unicellular bacteria, algae, yeast, and protozoa, each with varying levels of awareness, appeared over the next 3.5 billion years. It is probable that, like us, these single-cell organisms began to multiply seemingly out of control and overpopulate their environment. They began to bump up against each other and wonder, will there be enough for me? It must have been scary for them, too. With that new enforced closeness and the consequent change in their environment, they searched for an effective response to their pressures. Those pressures led to new and glorious era in evolution, in which single cells joined together in altruistic multicellular communities. The end result was humans, or near the top of the evolutionary ladder. Similarly, I believe that the stresses of the increasing human population will be responsible for pushing us up against another rung on the evolutionary ladder. We will, I believe, come together in a global community. The members of that enlightened community will recognize that we are made in the image of our environment, i.e. that we are divine, and that we have to operate not in a survival of the fittest manner, but in a way that supports everyone and everything on this planet. Survival of the most loving. You may agree that Rumi's words on the power of love are noble ones, but you may not believe that they fit these troubled times when survival of the fittest may seem more appropriate. Isn't Darwin right that violence is at the core of life? Isn't violence the way of the natural world? What about all those documentaries that show animals stalking animals, animals snaring animals, animals killing animals? Don't humans possess an inborn inclination to violence? The logic goes, animals are violent, humans are animals, and therefore humans are violent. Period. No. Humans are not stuck with the innate, viciously competitive nature any more than we are stuck with the genes that make us sick or make us violent. Chimps, who are the closest to humans genetically, offer evidence that violence is not necessarily a part of our biology. One species of chimp, namely the bonobos, create a peaceful community with co-dominant males and females. Unlike other chimps, the community of bonobos operates not with a violence-driven ethic, but with an ethic that can be described as, quote, make love, not war. When chimps in the society become agitated, they don't engage in bloody fights. They diffuse their diversive energy by having sex. Recent research by Stanford University biologists Robert M. Saplowski and Lisa J. Scher has found that even wild baboons, among the most aggressive animals on the planet, are not genetically mandated to be violent. In one well-studied baboon troop, the aggressive males died out from contaminated meat. They foraged from a tourist garbage pit. In the wake of their deaths, the social structure of the troop was reinvented. Research suggests that females help steer the remaining less aggressive males into more cooperative behaviors, which led to a more uniquely peaceful community. In an editorial in the Public Library of Science Biology, where the Stanford research was published, chimp researcher Franz B. M. Daval of Emory University wrote, "Even the fiercest primates do not forever need to stay this way." In addition, no matter how many National Geographic specials you've watched, there is no dog-eat-dog imperative for humans. We are at the top of the predator-prey food chain. Our survival is dependent on eating organisms lower in the hierarchy. But we are not subject to being eaten by organisms higher in the chain. Without natural predators, humans are spared from becoming prey and from all the violence that the term implies. This does not mean that humans are outside the laws of nature, of course, for eventually we too shall be eaten. We are mortal, and following our demise, one would hope after a long and violence-free life, our corporal remains will be consumed and recycled back into the environment. Like a snake turning on itself, humans at the top of the food chain will eventually be devoured by organisms that are lowest on the food chain, the bacteria. So we are going to continue, we're going to conclude our look at this book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Conscious Matters and Materials, in the next show. So please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.